Welcome back to the Soundtracker Podcast. I'm your host, Eric Peacock. So today I'm doing Mission Impossible, and I'm joined by Light the Fuse, the official Mission Impossible podcast over with Paramount. It's a really good show. They've had, as we talk about in this, they've had Christopher McQuarrie, they've had Tom Cruise, Simon Pegg. I mean, they've had all kinds of people on the show. And so really cool having them on here to talk about this. But this kicks off Blockbuster Month. So the next month will be this episode follow, and it's all going to be, unfortunately, the last one is what kind of screwed things up. I wanted to call it Summer Blockbuster Month, but I forgot that the last movie that I'm doing for the show's 2 year came out in like December, if I remember correctly. But we are doing Mission Impossible, The Lion King, Back to the Future, and Space Jam for the show's 2 year anniversary. So make sure you tune into all of those because it's going to be a really great month. And as always, Patreon. Check out the show over on Patreon, www.patreon.com/soundtracker, where you can get set up with bonus episodes, 2 per month. And as always, give the show a rating wherever you listen. But those, the Patreon, we need to get some more people checking that out. It's free for 7 days. And like I said, you're going to end up with, you know, a whole litany of bonus episodes that are already recorded and 2 more going forward every month. So check it out if you have not, because the show, I'm hitting the 2 years soon, and I would like it to continue to year 3. All right. Enjoy.
Ain't no use running, ain't nowhere to hide. The beast is coming, and he's got you in his sights. He ain't gonna miss you, and he ain't gonna mess around. You're a movie with original songs. The soundtrack are gonna track you down! Oh, yeah!
All right, everyone, welcome back. So I'm kicking off Blockbuster Month this month, and I'm starting with Mission Impossible, which I've wanted to get to. You know, Mission Impossible, the first two had these very different and very of-the-time sort of soundtracks. And I tend to prefer the first movie, so that was why it was like, I'm glad to be getting to this one here. We're doing Mission Impossible 1, and joining me are the hosts of the Light the Fuse podcast, which is the official Mission Impossible podcast. I'm joined today by Charles Hood and Drew Taylor. How are you doing?
I'm going to speak for Charles and say we're good. We are feeling frisky, and we love the music of the first Mission Impossible film. Charles, do you concur?
Yeah, absolutely. 100% frisky. That's how I'm feeling as well.
Okay. Well, good.
Let's talk real quick. So your show, I mean, you have had Simon Pegg, Tom Cruise. I mean, the big buildup here is Tom Cruise. You had Tom Cruise on your show. Was that like an intimidating? Because I've had, you know, people that I've admired on my show, and I'm always like a little nervous to have them on. And I can't imagine what it must be like being like, I'm going to have Tom Cruise on my podcast. So how did that feel?
Well, are we some of the people that you are intimidated by? Because that
100%
that'll really dictate the tenor of this interview. Yeah.
Yeah. That's what I was getting at.
Well, it's okay. Two things. Like, for one, like when Tom Cruise first popped up on our podcast, it was a surprise because the writer director of the last 3 Mission Impossible movies, Christopher McQuarrie, like organized the Zoom and had Tom Cruise Zoom bomb us essentially in the car on his ride home from Wimbledon. And he ended up talking to us on it was our 200th episode of our old version of our show before we became official. And Tom Cruise ended up talking to us for 45 minutes, which was amazing. So it was a surprise. So there wasn't really like, you know, we were taken sort of off guard by it. But I think the other thing is that we had done the show for 4 years up to that point, talking to people who, to me, I think Drew does this for a living. He's a journalist. He talks to a lot of people. So it's not as intimidating for him. But for me, you know, we talked to Robert Elswit, who's the Oscar-winning cinematographer who, you know, has shot a lot of Paul Thomas Anderson's movies. He did Ghost Protocol and Rogue Nation, so 2 of the Mission Impossible movies. Talking to him was really intimidating to me. We did that in person before COVID, and I was very nervous about that interview. And then we talked to Brian De Palma in 2021, I think. I mean, that was very intimidating, but it was amazing. So like we had it's a good buildup of 4 years of talking to amazing guests of people who worked on these movies, you know, to build up to it.
Yeah, and McQuarrie's a big one too. Like one of my absolute favorite movies of the 2000s is The Way of the Gun. Like, I'm a huge fan of, and obviously his work with the Mission Impossible series too. So yeah, I mean, basically what I'm getting at here is now by extension, I can, like, I don't know, I'm kind of new to podcasting, but to me, this means that essentially Tom Cruise has been on my show because he's been on your show. And I can tell people when I talk to them, I'll be like, yeah, this podcast, Tom Cruise has been on it. And when they ask which episode, I'm just going to like send them your episode and then be like, well, see, that's the way podcasting works, like symbiosis here. You know, I've officially had him on my show now, and I can lie about that to people.
Yeah,
that's how that works.
Whatever we can do to help, sure. Yeah, I say tell whoever, you know, at cocktail parties, wherever you're at, just tell them, yeah, he was there.
Yeah, I'm too intimidated by YouTube to say that I've had, you know, YouTube.
yes, understandable.
No. Okay, so this is the point where I usually ask my guests like why this movie, but I feel like that's pretty self-explanatory here. You know, we have two Mission Impossible movies that have the kind of soundtrack that fits this criteria, and really either one would have worked, but you know, you're hosting the official Mission Impossible podcast, so I think that that's pretty self-explanatory as to why.
So did MI3 not have an official soundtrack? Because there were the Kanye West songs, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, first one to not have one, so... Well, let's do a little background on Mission Impossible before we talk the movie a little bit. So Mission Impossible opened on May 22nd, 1996, which is a Wednesday, and it came out to mostly positive reviews, and it proved to be a huge success at the box office. At the time, it was a record. It opened in 3,012 theaters, and it was the first film to play in more than 3,000 theaters opening weekend. And it broke the record for a film opening on a Wednesday with $11.8 million, beating the previous record of $11.7 million. So it wasn't very far off, but it's still a record by Terminator 2 Judgment Day. And it set several house records in several theaters across the United States as well. It earned $45 million in its first weekend and smashed the short-lived record held by Twister for the biggest May opening weekend at the time it came out. So that was just the previous year that Twister came out. But it grossed $75 million in its first 6 days. It surpassed Jurassic Park and took in more than $56 million over the four-day Memorial Day weekend. Two weeks in a row, it topped the box office. The Rock eventually came in and displaced it. But Cruise, for his part, deferred his usual $20 million fee for a significant portion of the box office percentage. So good on his part, because this movie went on to make $457 million worldwide against a box office, against a budget of $80 million. So just, I mean, like I said, this is a good one to kick off Blockbuster Month, because this was a giant success at the box office. And the top 10, the week that this movie came out, number one, Mission Impossible. Oh shit. No, Twister came out. I did this list like a week ago, and I forgot Twister was the exact same summer as Mission Impossible. So it was like very short-lived, very short-lived record by Twister. So number one was Mission Impossible. Number two was Twister. Number three was Spy Hard. Number four was Flipper. Number five was The Truth About Cats and Dogs. Number six was The Craft. Number seven was Toy Story. Number eight was Primal Fear. Number nine was The Birdcage. And number 10 was Heaven's Prisoners. So again, that's like a pretty varied top 10 films. Flipper in the middle of there. I forgot there was a Flipper movie in 1996. So the movie itself, it was a big road getting it made. Paramount had been working on a film adaptation for years, and Cruise actually was the one who decided he's going to take Mission Impossible as his inaugural project for Cruise Wagner Productions, his new production company. And you know, he convinced Paramount to put $70 million into the budget, and his partner Paula Wagner worked on a story with Sidney Pollack for a few months, and he met De Palma while working on Interview with a Vampire and Steven Spielberg, and he was really impressed with the meeting, and he went back home and watched all of De Palma's films and convinced himself he was the guy to direct Mission Impossible. And I'm sure we'll talk about this when we get to the movie, but I really do think for this particular adaptation, if you want to call it that, of a Mission Impossible story, I don't think there's a better director that you could have chosen than De Palma for this specific iteration of the Mission Impossible story. You know, like he's the perfect director for this, because it wasn't as action heavy as like the John Woo sequel or the Abrams part three. So I really do think De Palma was the best choice for this movie.
Correct.
There was a whole bunch of screenwriters brought in. De Palma was designing the action sequences, but they weren't satisfied with the story that they would take place. So Robert Towne, who was one of the writers, ended up organizing a beginning, middle, and end to hang story details on, while De Palma and David Kep worked on the plot. Cruz was the one who approved the script for the showdown atop the moving train, which, again, you know, that's a 100% knowing what we know about Cruz now and his like desire to get out there and do the wildest shit imaginable for stunts. Like, I could see why that appealed to him. Like, looking at this, like, oh yeah, a scene on top of a moving train. Like, yeah, let's get this done. So they were denied initially using the TGV, Francis High Speed Train, for filming, but Cruz dined with the TGV owners, and the following day the crew gave them permission. He's a charmer, you know, like a very charming guy. So they had to get, for that look, they had to use wind powerful enough to look like it would blow him off of the train. And he thought about these simulators that he used while he trained as a skydiver. And so they located the only machine of its kind in Europe, and they brought it in, and it was 140 mile an hour winds that would distort his face. And so they everything kind of fell into place. And despite all of the setbacks that had occurred making this, the filmmakers delivered the film on time and under budget, which was like a really rare thing at this point in Hollywood. There was a whole issue with like everything ballooning over budget and coming in way late. And
the last time that ever happened in Hollywood history, the last time anything ever came in over budget or late. Yeah.
And there were also rumors that De Palma and Cruz didn't get along, because at the last minute, De Palma excused himself from scheduled media interviews, but at the time he was also going through a divorce, which is also like the likely reason that happened. But it, like, there's like a persistent rumor that those two did not get along. And it's like kind of one of those who's to say situations, because, you know, we'll never know, but it makes sense that it would be because of his divorce more than anything else. Now, very famously, the original cast of the television show hated this movie. Greg Morris was absolutely disgusted with the treatment of Phelps's character. Peter Graves, who played Phelps, disliked how he turned out in the film to be a traitor. Martin Landau was like the most angry about it. He said that he, like, you know, he talked all kinds of shit about it. The script wasn't very good, and he didn't. But I get that. Like, if you were in the original series and you saw this and I don't know, I guess you would be like, this is my thing, and they're totally changing everything. But that's one of the things I like about it, because this movie keeps you guessing pretty much from that opening bit where all of a sudden the entire team is gone. You know, like, you don't know what the hell's going to happen. Yeah. And at the end of the day, John Voight's a great scumbag. So it works. And then finally, Apple had a $15 million promotion linked to the film that included a game, print ads, and television spots. And at the time, the Apple computer in the film was not even one in existence. They had to use like a screen from another computer. It actually had not come out yet, but it was like their cutting edge technology that they used to wedge into this movie. And actually, one last tidbit here, I forgot. This was the last movie from, and this shocked me, because it was 1996. This is the last film from a major studio to be released on Betamax in home video format when it came out. I didn't realize Betamax still existed in 1996.
Need to get that, Charles, for the archives.
Yeah, that's a must-have. Must-have.
Yeah. All right. Well, okay. Let's start the movie for a little bit when we get into the soundtrack. So, like I said, De Palma was the best choice for this particular adaptation. And one of the things, the way this movie keeps you guessing, because I saw this in theaters. I would have been 15, almost 16 when this came out. And so you see Emilio Estevez. And there's a really good head fake, because he's like the first person you see. And it makes you think Emilio was a pretty famous actor at the time. And you kind of think like he's very important as a character. And it's so funny that he's completely uncredited. And his death is like one of the things that I remember the most. I will always, like, till the day I die, remember the death that they give Emilio Estevez in this movie. It's one of those really gnarly and kind of darkly funny deaths that he gets in this. But, you know, this is pre-internet days. I didn't know about Tom Cruise's uncredited cameo in Young Gun. So it's kind of funny that it was just kind of that again, but with Emilio Estevez this time, only in a much more prevalent role. But you get the, and it's very obviously Tom Cruise in Kiev there it's not obvious the first time you see it, but watching it now, I was like, it's so funny that I didn't realize this was Tom Cruise in this mask trying to squeeze this guy for information right now at the beginning. But you jump right into the end of their mission, which is a really great way to start it. You know, there's no setup. It's just like the way this mission ends, where they're trying to get this information. You see the practical mask come off, which is the last time they ever did one of these practically in this, but just a really great opening for this movie.
No, yeah. I mean, just like the opening of this movie is like, it really blew my mind when Cruise steps forward, that shot that pushes in on him when he pulls off the mask is just, that just like my whole world exploded. I was like, oh my God, this is the coolest thing ever.
But Cruise is the perfect Ethan Hunt also. And I forget watching the first one now how different Ethan Hunt is at like the first part of this movie before everything goes to shit. You know what I mean? Like he's very, that scene at the beginning when you meet Phelps and he's talking to the team and he's got that young, brash, like not rookie quality, but you know what I mean? Like he's still the young gun in the group. And just very jarring because I haven't seen the first one in a while.
Well, we watch the first one every 3 weeks and we can attest that it holds up. Very good.
And the thing is, watching this for the first time, you do not think that like all of these people are going to die. That's one of the things that just really like watching it last night, the way it sets this up, like you're never going to, there's a part where when everyone's dying, Ethan is kind of like the stand-in for the audience where he's like, this can't be happening. Like we can't lose. We can't die. Like that's not how this works. We're not supposed to lose here. And I kind of forgot that Jack calls him Foghorn last night because I was like, it kind of sounds like Ethan's doing a Foghorn Leghorn accent at this party here as the old man.
Yeah, we love that. We love him doing the senator. What was the line where he's like, we were living in a democracy the last time I checked.
So good. I might be saying this name wrong. This is one of those names I never know if I've gotten right. Is it Czerny? Henry Czerny? Is that how you say his name?
I don't actually know. Henry Czerny is what I've always said. And that's what I've heard, but we should have asked him. We actually interviewed him recently and we have our episodes with him are coming out the next couple weeks. And I wish we'd asked him directly, but I think it's Henry Czerny or Czerny. Yeah.
So I did not know, cause I have not had a chance to see Dead Reckoning yet. I've been too busy, but I was really glad to see he comes back in Dead Reckoning. Apparently he's like, yeah, he's listed in the cast list.
Yeah, that is great. He's back. Christopher McQuarrie brought him back, which is like, we've been waiting for this for so long. It's amazing. Because one of the things that's funny about the Mission Impossible series is that throughout the movies, he always has a different boss. Like, it's just always dealing with all these different middle management bosses. And we love a lot of, like, the Anthony Hopkins is in the second one, Lawrence Fishburne's in the third one, Tom Wilkinson is in the fourth one, he gets dispatched. Then we got Alec Baldwin in 5 and 6. Like, he's just always dealing with all these different bosses. But we always want some of them to return. In particular, we wanted Kittredge to come back from the first one because Henry Czerny's line delivery is just so distinct and wonderful. So we were so thrilled to have him back in this movie.
I tried to watch this last night like I was seeing it for the first time, which is hard to do knowing, but I did my best. And I'm watching it. They do such a good job at making it seem like this guy's your villain, kind of. You know what I mean? He delivers these lines and there's that like De Palma. De Palma doesn't do a lot of De Palma stuff in this movie. You know what I mean? Like there's not
incorrect,
a ton of...
Incorrect. We have to just stop this podcast right now. That is not
awakened.
True. First of all...
You've awakened the beast.
Okay. Let me hear it. I want to hear.
Well, first of all, like you're saying, he kills off the entire team in the first 10 minutes of the movie. Who else that perverse? You know what I mean? Like, that is such a De Palma thing. The death of Emilio is such a De Palma flourish. And
let me walk back what I meant. I didn't mean this is why, the reason I said De Palma is perfect for this is because the story and the beats like that are perfect De Palma. What I mean is De Palma had a very distinct visual style. Like the split screens and stuff, you know what I mean? And I don't mean that in a bad way. Like you still see them. The reason I brought that up is that low angle shot on Kittredge when he's talking, but I'll let you continue. I just didn't want to like, I didn't mean that like there's no De Palma.
But are you suggesting that his visual flourishes are not on display throughout Mission Impossible?
They are.
We would argue that they are.
Okay.
And there's a split screen in the opening sequence that we're talking about. That whole thing with the elevator, that is an in-camera split screen. I mean, there's split diopters. I mean, it's anamorphic, all crazy anamorphic lenses.
So many first-person shots.
first person shots.
Like, exactly.
First person shots where people interact with the camera. Like nobody does first person like De Palma does, where he's actually walking through a scene as Ethan Hunt and people are talking to the lens as if the audience is Ethan Hunt. Like, nobody does stuff like that.
No.
And you're right.
This is as De Palma-y a De Palma movie as can be. And he already resurrected an old TV show in beautifully immaculate cinematic form with The Untouchables. He did the same thing here. It is totally of a piece. It is totally in keeping with his thematic and visual obsessions. Your Honor, all the voyeurism, I strike this down. Like, yeah.
Like, you know, De Palma does so much with voyeurism right from the opening shot. It's Emilio Estevez watching someone through, you know, watching the team and through on the TV screen on the monitor, you know, like there's so much there, so much about, and also they have to set up the glasses to watch Golitsyn when he's taking the disc, and there's just there's Ethan hanging above Donlo in Langley, like there's just so much watching, and
even the idea of a mask had previously been introduced in Body Double. I mean, that is a huge part of that movie, is the mask and watching someone commit a crime with a mask on, and then the mask being, you know, revealing the true perpetrator later on in the movie. This whole thing is De Palma front to back, top to bottom.
The only thing I would say that doesn't get to get in there is any like the weird sex stuff, but then you could also argue, I mean, Ethan's like, he's sort of macking on his mentor's
wife.
that gets a little bit weird there. I mean, I think there was a sex scene that was cut out, but there's still, it's like a tamer sex stuff that De Palma does in this one.
All right, you convinced me. I still think when I said that, I guess I should have said, I didn't mean thematically, because I do agree with you. A lot of the things you mentioned, I still do think visually, I'm not going to argue the point.
another thing I want to say too, staircases. He loves staircases in all of his movies. And the embassy in that whole opening first act you're talking about, where the whole thing goes on, where the whole team gets killed off. They're in this area that is just, it's a giant room of just staircases. It's all staircases. Yeah. It's such an interesting visual. And obviously he always does staircases in his movies.
Yeah, I'm just gonna have my editor cut me saying that there's no De Palmaisms and then just like leave it where you're just screaming at
me. No, we have to. Litigation has to be left in. We have to have that.
No.
We have to stand up for our boy.
No, it's fine. You're right about, as soon as you push back on that, I was like, I'm curious. And then when you started talking thematically, I was like, shit, I should have said, I do think, and the POV is one of the things that I did have, the part where Ethan's walking through the party and you see the point of view shots. Like, maybe I was just thinking of that too much last night if I went back and watched it again. Because I did just recently went through like a bunch of old De Palma stuff, not knowing I was doing this episode. It was just one of those things where I was like, I watched, you know, Body Double and Blowout and I don't know. Maybe it's just because I last night wasn't looking for it properly. I was taking notes too, so I'm trying to make excuses for why if I get yelled at by the audience too about this. So some of the minor characters in this too. I forgot that Vanessa Redgrave was in this movie. Jean Renault too, for his reputation for being, you know, most people think of Jean Renault, they think of like Leon the Professional, but you forget how funny he is, because even though he's like a villain in this ultimately, he's kind of the comic relief throughout the early parts of this movie, where he's like mugging it up. I mean, he's making like hammy faces early in the movie, or the part where he's like scared of a rat in the heating duct when he's holding Ethan up. I kind of forgot how his character is kind of used as comic relief in this movie. And like I said, it's been a while since I've seen this, though. It's the cartoon face. The face when he sneezes is the part where he really fucking hams it up when he's doing that face. It's like, something you'd see in like a Foghorn Leghorn cartoon, to go back to a theme here. But yeah, him and Ving Rhames together, I kind of wish that Krieger had not been made a villain, just to see more of Jean Renault pop up in these movies. But he also kind of works as a villain. You want to know something my stupid little brain thought, and I forgot about this till I watched it last night when I was, when I saw this movie for the first time, I was a 15-year-old. I was certain that, because it is Chekhov's exploding gum in this movie, twice actually, you get it used twice. but I was 100% certain that someone was going to be offered a piece and chew it when I was like 15 years old watching this for the first time. That's where I thought they were going with this, that you're going to get some really awesome, like somebody just exploding, chewing a piece of gum, which at 42, looking back on it, I was like, I was a fucking idiot when I was 15 years old thinking something like that might happen. I still think they should do that in like a, go back and make a director's cut where someone chews it. I think it's because who gives him the gum? Is it Jack that gives him the gum, right? It's Jack that hands him the stick of gum. Yeah. And he jokingly says, try not to chew on it. And I think that's when I was like, some villain's going to, like, Cruz is going to, I don't know why, like I said, this is, well, I know why. I was 15 years old and half paying attention to the movie, but I thought that was where they were going with that. So when you compare this with 2 and 3 and then the later films, do you feel, because one of the things I last night watching this too, is this is, I feel, the twistiest. I don't think any of the other ones have tried to do as many twists as this one pulls on. You know what I mean? Like this, that would be another De Palma thing I would say too, is that this one tosses more twists than any of the later installments do. I just want to see if I get yelled at for saying that. I feel like I'm correct on that. Like, this is the twisty.
We might yell you. I mean, yeah. I'm trying to think. I mean, like 2 has some misdirections. Are they like full on twists as like a big twist as big as Phelps? Probably. You're probably right. I mean, I think there are like mini twists. I mean, there's like, you know, like McCrory does a lot of that in the later ones. In Fallout has a lot of like back and forth of like people outsmarting each other. But are they like full on twists? No, I guess. Yeah, I would say that that's probably true, that the first one is. I mean, it's funny because the first one got criticized at the time for being so complicated, and that reputation still holds in some places, which is really weird to us because watching it, it's not that complicated. And it's actually like the one movie in the whole series that actually makes the most sense. I think all the other ones have a little things here and there where you're like, well, that doesn't really make sense, but you just go with it. But the first movie, I think, is actually a really tight screenplay.
Oh, 100%. Especially knowing, like, I didn't know how troubled's the wrong word, but this was a difficult production getting it written.
Yeah. I think troubled's the right word. But you know, they all have their own journey to the big screen. And
yeah,
that is one of the things that we love to celebrate, is just all those kind of wrong turns and dead ends and other things that the productions take before they finally kind of get to this amazing final product that we all enjoy so much. So, yeah, I mean, I don't think it was an easy movie to make at all, but I think that the combined creative vision of all of these amazing people, you know, Steve Zaillian and Robert Towne and David Koepp, who we adore, you know, really worked hard to bring this kind of singular vision to life. So, yeah.
Yeah, that was one of our best interviews, is with David Koepp, who is, you know, one of the credited writers on this movie and is probably the chief, I would say, chief architect of the script in the end. I know Zaillian has a story credit, and I think does Robert Towns share this writing credit or the story credit?
Yes, I'm looking at the poster right now. Story by David Koepp and Steve Zaillian. Screenplay by David Koepp and Robert Towne.
Yeah, yeah. And so we had an interview with David Koepp that is really wonderful. And then we also did an episode on, we were able to track down the Robert Towne draft of the movie, which was in between. So basically David Koepp came on and wrote drafts, and then they brought in Robert Towne to do a draft. And then after Robert Towne's draft, Koepp had to come back and combine all the best elements of his early drafts and Robert Towne's draft into a new script, which was the final version that was shot. And so we tracked down the Robert Towne draft from the first AD, Chris Soldo, of the first movie. We interviewed him, and he had like a whole archive. And he's like, I've got this random disc. It's like an old, like not a floppy disk, but like a hard disk of the from like the 90s. He's like, and it says, it says Robert Towne's draft from whatever the date was, 1995 or whatever. And we were like, oh my God, can we please have that? And he sent us the file, and we had to like go through getting it converted. And we did an episode where we read excerpts from Robert Towne's draft, and like we were able to figure out kind of what Robert Towne contributed to the script and what David Koepp contributed. It was a really fun exercise. And it's fun to hear Drew do voices too.
I can agree with that. Yeah.
Did you do the Foghorn Leghorn thing when you were reading it at your table read? Did you try the
Foghorn Leghorn? We didn't have that. We didn't. There wasn't any additional dialogue with our favorite character, the Southern senator. But yeah, it's a fun episode for sure.
You know, I have a question for the two of you then. The Mission Impossible series, I'll ask each one separately. We'll start with you, Charles. What was your entry point to Mission Impossible? Was it the first film? Was it one of the later films? Was it the old series? What started your love for this particular franchise?
Yeah, the first Charles, movie. I mean, when the trailer came out for this movie, I freaked out. I was like, oh my God, this is the coolest thing. That trailer blew my mind. And my dad was like, oh, because my dad grew up watching the old show. And so he was like, you got to go watch the old show. And at the time, there was no internet. This is like early 1996. So I'm probably 13. And my dad worked, Drew and I both grew up in Connecticut. And my dad worked in New York City. And there was the Museum of Television and Radio in New York City. And so I would take the train in to go to the Museum of Television and Radio and watch episodes of the old show before the movie came out, because my dad was like, you got to do this. And so how the start of my obsession. They actually had like a VHS you could buy from the Museum of Television and Radio that had like three episodes on it. I brought those home and watched them all the time, and then saw the movie. I was obsessed with the movie, watched the VHS, wore out the VHS for the first movie. And that was the beginning of my obsession. And I think Drew, I don't think was as big into the old show, but I think the first movie was his beginning of his, but you can speak more to that, Drew, and then maybe also we should talk about our Ghost Protocol experience.
I had basically the same experience as Charles, but without the loving the old show and going into New York, because I was in Texas at the time. Charles and I met in 1999, so a few years away from our beginnings of our beautiful relationship. But I was obsessed. Yeah, I wore out my VHS tape. I just thought it was the coolest movie. I was also obsessed with animation and visual effects. So all of the ILM stuff in that first movie also really, really blew my mind. And I think Charles and I saw the second movie together in Connecticut. And then I don't think we saw the third movie together. And then it just so happened that we were in New York at the same time for the fourth movie. And we went to like a 2 p.m. screening of Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol in IMAX during the kind of like IMAX roadshow presentation, which was a week earlier than when it was everywhere. This was Christmas of 2011, Charles?
Yeah.
So we went and we just had like the time of our lives. We thought it was maybe the greatest thing we'd ever seen. And we were hooting and hollering and we were blown away. We went to a talk with Brad Bird at Lincoln Center later that night. And it was just, it was a really transformative experience. It was sort of just the most fun thing I'd seen in the movies theater in a long, long time. And we were sort of blown away because I think we really like 3, but we love 4. So that was just amazing. And so from then on, we just were texting all the time about it. And we saw 5 together. And we would send theories about every time there was a trailer or a new piece of news or something. And then in the lead up to Fallout, we said, like, let's just do this podcast. We really didn't think it would be anything. And then 5 years later, we are the official Mission Impossible podcast. And, getting access to all these wonderful people who we've loved for many, many years. So it's just been a real thrill, a totally unexpected joy. And I am glad that our professional lives have forced Charles to hang out with me, which is really the big the goal all along. And so that's the win. That's the win. Yeah.
Okay, so I've seen recently there's been, and I this is because I spend too much time, even though I've lessened my time on that shit site, I've spent too much time on, and I'm not calling it X, I spend too much time on Twitter and see the discourse. And one of the things that I've seen recently, and I want to see how you two feel about this, I've seen a lot of groundswell lately that 2 is superior to 3. A lot of people who have come out and said that 3's not very good and 2 is the superior of the first 3 sequels or the first 2 sequels. And I never thought that it would come to that. You know what I mean? I don't dislike John Woo's. I like part 2. It's definitely the most, it's so John Woo. It is so fucking John. Like where I said that about De Palma earlier and got yelled at, I will not say that about part 2 and John Woo. You know what I mean? Like that is as John Woo as an action film as I've seen. However, it was always the consensus that 3 was kind of the return to form for people that like the first one. And I'm seeing, it's kind of saying the prequels are good for Star Wars now. Like, I'm seeing a lot of people that are like, well, part two is actually better than part three. How do you feel about that?
Yeah, that there does seem to be a little bit of a groundswell. I've noticed that as well around the release of this new one. We love all the movies. You know, Drew and I have always had the same rankings for the movies. Like, you know, when we started the show, we built up to an episode. It was probably like, it was an early episode, like, I don't know, episode 9 or 10 of our old show, of which there are like over 200 episodes. But when we got to that episode, we did not reveal to each other what our rankings were going to be for the movies. And then we went one by one ranking them from, I don't even want to say worst to best. I want to say least best to most best. And we ended up having the exact same rankings. And we had two at the bottom and then three at second to last. And I do think that there is a, and then Drew, you can chime in and let me know if you agree or disagree, but I think that two and three are at the bottom, and then there's a pretty significant leap to all the rest of the movies in the series. Now, and I love so many aspects of two and three, but they just don't really cohere as well as the other movies, I think. And there's some lower lows in those movies, but like there are moments that I love. Like in two, there's the knife in the eye moment, which is incredible, where they put an actual knife in Tom Cruise's eye and had a cable attached to it so that Doug Ray Scott, who played the villain, was like trying to stab him, and the knife was basically tickling Tom Cruise's eyelashes, which is just absolutely insane. And there's obviously all the motorcycle jousting stuff, and there's a lot of fun things in two that I love. And then in three, the Vatican heist, I think, is one of the coolest, like most like perfect Mission Impossible heist sequences. Like, it's so great. There's just so much to love. And there's all other things, like the lip reading in three is really wonderful, and Philip Seymour Hoffman's performance, obviously. And so there's a lot to love, but I think that those two for me are lower than the rest, and I would still put two at the bottom, and then I would put three above it. And I love John Woo, but I think he was kind of neutered with two, because it's a PG-13, and I think there's a longer cut of that movie somewhere that we'll never see that maybe it was better. Who knows? What do you think, Drew?
Yes. Yeah, I love them all. And, you know, like Charles said, even if you don't like two or don't like three, there's so much to enjoy in both. And so much personality to both. I mean, like, nobody else could have made three but JJ, and nobody else could have made two but John Woo. And, you know, we can talk about the degree of which Woo actually shines through in two. But, I mean, yeah, it's just wonderful. It's just been such a wonderful franchise to allow filmmakers this like huge platform to get their kind of like, you know, messages and sensibilities and stylistic flourishes across. It's just great. You know, I can't get this across to you, but we really enjoy this franchise. Really excited that we really like.
Drew and I have identical rankings, which was a shock to us at the time. But like, what's funny is that he and I have the exact same rankings. But what's so amazing is that everybody out there, it's always happens every once in a while on Twitter, like the cycle comes back around. People say like, oh, what are your rankings for the Mission Impossible movies? And then everybody puts their rankings out, and everyone's rankings are so different. And that just speaks to the quality of all the movies in this
and
series.
Everyone's rankings. You go, yeah, I could see that. Yeah. I go with that. You know, like there's never a time when you go like, what are you thinking? That one is lower. It's like, no, it's very easy to see why people choose their favorites and how they choose their favorites. Cause they're just such a delight.
And with a lot of other franchises, there's a general consensus of like the one or two that are the best in the series, but that's not really the case with this, because there's just so much quality throughout, and it's different strokes, different folks. Like some people are just like, I'm a Rogue Nation person. Like, I just love Rogue Nation. I love the introduction of Rebecca Ferguson or whatever. And then the other people who are like, oh my God, Fallout is the best in the series by far. And it's like, yeah, like Drew said, like, I'm like, I can't disagree with you. Yep. Cool.
I guess I was kind of softening the edges a little bit, because I didn't want to, but I am not really a big fan of part two. I was trying to be nice about it when I was talking about it. I would 100% with you, where Two is 100% without question my least favorite. Three would be second from the bottom. One would be my favorite. I would really have to think about the middle because I hadn't, and I still haven't seen The Reckoning. So like, I can't really have a complete list right now. But two gives the best line in the series. Maybe not. It may be ironically the best line where, and it's been a while since I've seen it, but what are they? They're like, what did we just do? And Cruz says very seriously, we just rolled up a snowball and threw it straight into hell, which is like one of those like really awesome action film lines. I love that.
Hi, everyone. So I'm back with another Patreon pitch, but something's changed this time. So I've been saying since the start of the Patreon that this is basically what's going to help keep this show going. And for people who might be sitting on the fence, I have something exciting. Patreon picked me as part of a test group to try free trials. So if you're someone who's been debating whether or not to get signed up, go to www.patreon.com/soundtracker, where you'll find my $3 tier, my $6 tier, and my $8 tier. The $3 tier comes with a 14-day free trial, and the $6 and $8 tiers come with a 30-day free trial. There's no commitment, and if you don't like it at the end of the month, you can cancel. But in that time, you can check out the bonus episodes and get a feel for it and see what you think. And if it's something you enjoy, hey, welcome aboard. But give it a shot. www.patreon.com/soundtracker. I'm not sure how long I'm going to be able to offer this, but as of now, it is something that I can offer. And it's exciting, and I'm hoping that this gets more people to check out these bonus episodes because there's some truly great stuff in there and more to come.
Okay, let's talk the soundtrack here. How's that sound?
Sure.
Yes. What a weird soundtrack. Let's do it.
And it's not really available anywhere anymore. We're talking about the soundtrack album, right? Not the score album.
Right. The
music, soundtrack album. The music from and inspired by.
The number of songs that actually appear in the film is actually hilarious. It might be the least of anything that I've done so far. Like the song on the album.
I know how many are in there just looking at the track listing. I mean, it's insane. But anyway.
So there were two soundtrack albums. One was the score album, as you said, and then the other was the one that we're discussing, which is all original songs, quote unquote original songs. For the movie. So as for the score, though, Alan Silvestri was originally hired to score this movie, and he had written roughly 23 minutes of music before he was taken off and replaced by Danny Elfman. So he recycled the material he had written and used it for the score to Eraser, which I didn't know this till I did this. This is something I did not know. And there are bootleg copies of his Mission Impossible score in circulation. So have you heard those? The original Silvestri score?
Yeah, you can, if you search around a little bit on YouTube, you can find that. And we talked, I think we've had it in our show notes for some of our episodes in the past. We talked to Paul Hirsch, the editor of the first movie, and he's Brian De Palma's editor for many years. And he talked a little bit about what happened with Alan Silvestri and then how Danny Elfman came on board. It's really interesting stuff. But I think actually we played a little bit of this, of the Alan Silvestri music in our music episodes that we did with Jeremy Dillon on our old show as well.
Oh, see, and you know what? I will link to that episode in, that's something I'm sure the audience for this would be really in tune for. So I'll link specifically to that episode in this episode description too, for everyone to check that one out when I put it up on the Apple and all that. So, all right. So the soundtrack we're talking about released on May 14th, 1996, and it proved to be pretty successful. It debuted at number 40. It peaked at number 16. It's certified gold. The top 10, the week that this soundtrack came out. Anyone who listens to my show, this is like the most, everyone in this top 10 list, basically, it's like the most 90s top 10 list in the world. It's like people who pop up in these top 10 lists constantly. So at number one, or albums that are in here constantly, number one, the Fugees, The Score was the number one album the week that this came out.
That album was just, it was everywhere. I'm sure all of them in the top 10 are. I'll shut up now. Yeah.
No, it's okay. This is number two. You wait till you hear number two. Number two, because this one literally pops up from like 1995 to like 1997. Alanis Morissette's Jagged Little Pill.
Oh yeah.
I'm not, it is in every top. It is in so many of these episodes that I've done where it's number somewhere in the top 10. Like
that. She had like 10 hit singles off that album. Of course it was around forever.
I know. Number three, Celine Dion, Falling Into You. Number four, this one will trick you. Hootie and the Blowfish, but it's not the one you're thinking of. This was actually Fairweather Johnson, not Cracked Rearview. This was their follow-up to Cracked Rearview, because Cracked Rearview is another one that is in the top 10 when I do it pretty much every other episode. If I do a movie that came out between 1995 and 1997, Cracked Rearview is somewhere in that top 10. Number five, Dave Matthews' Crash. I won't talk about how I don't like Dave Matthews, because I talk about that all the time. Number six, George Michael's Older. Number seven, Tracy Chapman's New Beginning. Number eight, The Cranberries' To the Faithful Departed. Number nine, Brooks and Dunn, Borderline. And number 10, Rage Against the Machine's Evil Empire. So, like I said, that is a 1996-ass top 10 list.
Can we just talk about Older for the rest of this episode? Charles and I are big fans of Fast Love. Really underrated. Yeah. One of the best.
We're big George Michael fans. Songs ever. Should we just talk about George Michael?
I'm okay with that. We'll just go down the track list for that and pretend it was the soundtrack to this movie. No one would know any different because none of the songs are in the movie. So further down the chart, these are three albums. I started this, just so you know, I started this feature because Alanis Morissette and Hootie and the Blowfish and TLC's Crazy Sexy Cool pop up so much in the top 10 that I was like, I got to do other albums in the top 200 just to give a better idea of the landscape of music at the time. So these are three albums that never made the Billboard top 10, but by artists you know or albums that you know. So number 28 was the Twister soundtrack, which peaked at number 28. Number 70 was Adam Sandler's What the Hell Happened to Me, which peaked at number 18. And at number 80, we had Smashing Pumpkins' Zero EP, which peaked at number 46. So, you know, that just to give you a better idea of what was going on in music at the time. So the first song on this soundtrack is Larry Mullen and Adam Clayton of U2, the theme from Mission Impossible. So a little bit of background on the original theme. It was written and composed by Lalo Schifrin. I always fuck up names. Lalo Schifrin. Is it Lalo or Lalo? Do you know?
I think it's Lalo
Schifrin. Lalo Schifrin. Yeah.
Lalo Schifrin. I thought it was Lalo, but I wasn't sure. The theme was written in a 5/4 time signature, which Schifrin has jokingly explained as being for people who have five legs. There's a recent suggestion that he started the song from Morse code 4MI because, and I'm not going to, I can't speak how Morse code looks, but where there's a dot is one beat and a dash is 1.5 beats. So the full bar gives us five beats, which exactly matches the underlying rhythm, but that can't be verified. It's just kind of something some person who knows more about music than I do came up with. But the original title for the song was Burning Fuse. Unlike the original, this version is in common time with the exception of the intro, but this song was a huge hit. You know what's funny? I don't remember this being as big of a hit as it was. Do you? I don't recall.
Oh, I remember there was a music video for it. I mean, I've always been a really big U2 fan, so I was very excited about this. Larry Mullen and Adam Clayton doing this version there was like a music video for it. I remember it being a pretty big deal at the time.
Yeah,
that's so weird that I don't remember that, because this is when I was like really watching MTV and stuff. So like, given this, it sold it. This song itself, on top of the album, is certified gold. 500,000 copies. It peaked at number one in seven on the Billboard Hot 100 in the US, number one in Finland, Hungary, Iceland, number two in Australia and Ireland, number seven in the UK. And the thing is, this is a really good rendition of that. Like the 5/4 signature is missing, but it kept it. One of the things you get with covers, and especially I feel like when you're doing an instrumental cover, is it's going to sound like karaoke if you just do the exact same song. You know what I mean? Like, what's the point in doing that if you do the exact same song? So like, it's got the percussion is bigger and more upfront. It's a really good way to start this soundtrack off.
Yeah, I think it's pretty cool. I love this track. Like, it's very synthy and fun. And it's like in keeping with what U2 was doing in the 90s at the time.
It's the two people from U2 that people really care about. Larry Mullen.
Well, it's like, you know, Bono and the Edge went off and wrote the GoldenEye song for the James Bond movie for Tina Turner to sing. So Larry and Adam were like, well, we got to do something. So then they go out and they do Mission Impossible.
that GoldenEye song just rules. But also, this was a golden age of like cool covers of instrumental TV themes. Like Orbital did the Saint theme in 97, Dust Brothers did the X-Files theme in 98 for the movie Fight the Future. We were really living in a golden era of cool people covering instrumental old TV show theme songs. So They kicked it off, baby. They kicked it off.
So at number two, we've got Massive Attack, Spying Glass from their album Protection. Massive Attack has obviously come up on the show a few times now. I love Massive Attack. And it's cool. The thing I like about this is a soundtrack selection from them before they even made Mezzanine. Mezzanine is like the high watermark for trip hop. And at the time that this album came out, Protection came out, trip hop had only been known as trip hop for like 3 months. This is when they started like compartmentalizing things into stupid sounding micro genres. And for lack of a better word, like this is adhering to trip hop, you know, like it still is. All the seeds are there. There's like that sultry blend of electronica and hip hop beats, but it's got a little bit of synth pop and reggae flavor in it. Like, it's great. Massive Attack are excellent. And this is a really cool song.
We're not even going to acknowledge songs that aren't in the movie, so you can just keep going.
Well, there's not going to be that many.
Yeah, I know. That's why we'll chime in when we will, you know? So, yeah.
At number three, you've got Pulp with I Spy from the album Different Class. It's one of the all-time great Britpop albums. The funny thing is, you see in these first few songs, they're going with the theme here. Spy in the title is like what they do. Well, what songs has spy in the title from popular bands right now? And this one, though, feels like it fits in here early on. Like, the guitars are very intriguey, if that makes sense. Like, it feels like you'd be listening to it over a scene of like intrigue. And then when Jarvis really gets going, it sounds like more Britpop. But like, I love Different Class. I love Pulp. And this is one of my favorites off of that. So this is a cool one. And like I said, it actually feels like it fits the movie, unlike some of the selections on here do. Like, some of them do not feel like they fit this movie at all, which is why they didn't appear. This one could have fit in somewhere, I feel like. And then you could actually say something about it.
We'll be sitting up on out. And yeah.
At number four, we got Danny Elfman with Impossible Mission. So I've really been in an Elfman zone lately. I've been binging on old Tales from the Crypt episodes. So, you know, that the Tales from the Crypt theme is an Elfman theme. And it's like one of those ones that I just have burned in my memory since I was however old I was when that show started. But I like the sort of marching band start to this one. And for an Elfman score piece, this is, now let's see if you agree with this. It's very much Elfman, but I feel like this one's kind of subdued and sparse for him, because Elfman has a thing. It's like big strings, it's big songs, and this one is not, you know what I mean? It's kind of subdued for him, and it's great, and it's great in the movie, though. It's like a great, it's not a bad thing. Like, it's just cool to hear him not doing.
Where do you find, because this is different from the final score. Like, the this track, Impossible Mission, is 5.5 minutes long. I assume it's using Sleeping Beauty, which is the opening track of the movie. Is that the marching band type thing you're talking about?
I think this is the Prague section of the movie.
Yep, that's exactly where it is.
Where how do you even find this track? And is it available anywhere? Like, YouTube, in this form?
We should also talk about how there are three different kinds of tracks from this movie: one from the score, one from the album, and then one from Music for a Darkened Theater Volume 1. Which has that has different tracks with completely different names. So it's a fucking mess trying to figure this out. But anyway,
I'd love to know.
This is a suite in the Prague section. Yeah.
Okay.
I didn't know anything about the darkened theater thing. Like, that is something I, even in like the Wikipedia, when I was going through the soundtrack stuff, it didn't mention that at all. Like, that there was a score and
like
soundtrack.
Danny Elfman had a couple of greatest, it was sort of like a best of Elfman album, Music from a Darkened Theater. I think there were two volumes of it as well. But they did it like early ones, and they did I think that they probably only go up to like the late 90s, and they didn't do many. But yeah, Mission is on there, and it's another named track, just to make it more confusing. So I'm curious. Yeah, I wish I knew exactly which cues it was using in this suite. It seems like there's a few suites by Elfman. Obviously, we'll get to the other ones in a bit. But he's known for more of the like gothic Tim Burton type stuff, or like Tales from the Crypt, like you mentioned. And this score, I think, is one of his best. It's really a remarkable score that I think he gets to some really emotional places, and he also just like hits the main Mission Impossible theme so well. It just hits it so hard. It's just awesome. I love it.
Yeah. And it, like you said, it, or like I said, it works really well in that prog scene too, because it really does feel like that fits the tone of how that scene plays out, that whole section plays out. And Elfman's great. He's somebody who's been talked about probably in like 20 episodes now, like, because he's always got, even if it's like a soundtrack like this and he did the score, they at least put one Elfman song on there because he's so good, you know. Plus Oingo Boingo has been in a few episodes I've done, so Elfman gets a lot of love here. At number five, we've got Bjork's Headphones from the album Post. And again, interesting choice here, because even by Bjork standards, this is not the most accessible song. Like, it's like, I mean, Bjork's always going to be like a fantastic weirdo and not like somebody who makes like accessible pop music. But like, even by those standards, like, there's not really even like a song structure at first. Like, there's no time signature. And then she starts doing this like hiccupy chanting when the vocals start. This isn't a bad thing if you like Bjork. I like Bjork. It's just a funny choice for this soundtrack. I'm just thinking of somebody who bought this soundtrack strictly for that U2 song and then got to the Bjork song and were like, I don't know what the fuck I'm hearing right now. Like, this is not what I bought this for, which was kind of the beauty of soundtracks. You would get shit that you weren't expecting. So at number six, we've got Skunk Anansie with Weak from the album Paranoid and Sunburnt. I talked about them before on Cruel Intentions, but this is arguably their biggest hit. This song was even covered by Rod Stewart on an album. So this was big enough that Rod Stewart covered it. But the thing I like about this band is they weren't afraid of doing sort of standard alt rock and then kind of turning it on its head. And their secret sauce was Skin. Their vocalist goes by the name of Skin. She has an unreal voice. And you pull her voice out of this, and this could have been any other post-grunge song from 1995, but like, she really brings something to this. And the guitars are like right in that sort of 90s, you know what I mean? That post-grunge, like kind of on the run up to nu metal sort of sound guitars that they had. And but it works because Skin's got such a great sort of control over her vocals and such a unique sound. At number seven, we got Long Pigs, On and On from their album Sun Is Often Out. These guys were, there's a lot of Britpop on here too, which is another thing. Like, there's a ton of, but not like, other than Pulp, none of the people who are like the mainstays of Britpop. Like, there's no Blur, there's no Oasis, there's no The Law. It's literally like Long Pigs or just the smaller ones. But they got pretty close to getting famous at the height of Britpop. This song was their biggest hit. And it's easy to see why. Like, this is a really pleasant song, really listenable. Doesn't feel like Britpop. It feels more like adult contemporary, like Counting Crows core. I don't know if that's a real term, but that's kind of what it feels like. But again, I like this one quite a bit. At number eight, we've got Danny Elfman's Claire, which is another Elfman score piece. Now, this is one that could have easily slotted into Batman Returns somewhere. Like, this kind of sounds like the song that might play when Penguin is getting his burial at sea, like by the Penguins. But it's really good. This is a more standard Elfman sort of score piece.
This is also a track that's not, it's not on the score, and it's not on Music for Dark and Theater Volume 2. So I'm not sure where this actually fits in the movie.
Yeah. Yeah. I was trying to figure it out too, by what it is, because there's love theme question mark on the score, which is 2:24. So that's shorter. And that's what plays, you know, when Phelps is talking about Claire with Ethan in the diner, where like when he finds out that John Voight's still alive. I don't know if it's a longer version of that, or if it's some other thing, or if it's a suite of Claire related cues. Yeah, so it's just like it's a fascinating that all these different versions of the releases here.
Yeah, I didn't know all of that. That's crazy.
That's why you have us on, to tell you the real shit about the different releases of the Mission Impossible 1 soundtrack album.
That's what we're good for.
That's the only thing we are good for. Yeah.
Well, you have to be able to say something about this next song. The next one is like a super famous song. It's the Cranberries' Dreams. The radio.
And it actually appears in the movie. It actually
Yeah, the only one that appears in the movie.
Yeah.
And you know, so this is off of their album. Everybody else is doing it. So why can't we? But this is a great song. Dolores's vocals are so clean. I've always loved this song. It's got that sort of dreamy jangle pop sound. Just one of those really, I kind of forget that it's the Cranberries when I hear it though. You know what I mean? It's kind of those songs that I forget, because this is like 92 when this came out.
What are you talking about? This is the most iconic Cranberry song ever.
I know
when people think of the Cranberries, I feel like it's this I mean, it's not as sort of politically charged or, you know, as some of their other stuff. But yeah, I think this is a lovely song. And it's obviously playing very faintly in the background when Tom and Ving are in the cafe at the end of the movie talking about their future with the IMF. But yeah, what a track.
Yeah, I love this song. I've always loved it. It's just it gets me every time. It's a good one to sing along to, although I don't think anyone wants to hear me do that.
You should do it. Just do it.
I like to do
just
it do with it. An Irish accent. myself,
yeah. So at number 10, we've got Gavin Friday with You, Me, and World War III, the big single remix from the album Shag Tobacco. He's been on here. I've talked about him before, too. He did a song on Romeo and Juliet called Angel. Really, this is only a remix insofar as there are some like minor electronic blurbs in it, but it sounds a lot like the original song, but it's good. He has this thing where he teases you, like he's going to do a big chorus and then he never quite gets there. And this one does that too, like Angel on Romeo and Juliet did. This one has more of a chorus to it, but he's good. He's just a very solid songwriter. At number 11, we've got Salt with the song So from their album Osticulate. Salt were a post-grunge band from Sweden. They had a minor hit called Bluster. This was another single that was less successful. This one kind of fooled me because at the start, it sounds like it's going to have like big Nickelback vocals, but then the singer has these really awesome, like Swedish airy vocals. But it's really good. Big earworm chorus. Really like this one. Okay, so here we are. Number 12, Danny Elfman's Trouble. I want to hear if you agree with me on this. I think this is 100% a cut song from Darkman, and you'll never convince me otherwise. Like, because it sounds so much like his score for Darkman. And I realize I've been saying that a lot of Elfman stuff, you could tell Elfman right when you hear it, but there always is like a theme to every movie that he does. And this sounds like almost like the main theme from Darkman is what this reminds me of. And I love Darkman and I love his score for Darkman. So that's not a bad thing. Like, that's a good thing.
Yeah, I love this track. There's different versions of this. Again, we're going to get into the different versions of the scores. This track in particular is amazing because it combines the beginning of the train sequence, which comes in with these amazing big horns and everything, which is so awesome. And then it builds and builds and builds until it hits the Mission Impossible theme in the climax. And it's all in one track. And none of the other score albums have this. They all separate the train.
The music
stuff
with the Darkened Theater version is 12 seconds shorter, but it's basically the same thing.
Does it? But it doesn't play the Mission Impossible theme, right?
No, it doesn't play the Mission Impossible theme.
Yeah, this is the only place where you get all that train stuff and the mission theme, which is so awesome.
Yeah, I think it's Zoom A and Zoom B on the soundtrack is where you get most of this.
Okay.
Yeah. But I would wear out the CD playing this track over and over again because I loved it so much, because I would just like relive watching the climax of the movie through listening to this track.
Yeah, I don't understand the Darkman connection. I think this is totally mission only. I feel like Darkman has much more kind of gothic overtones, but maybe when he's, you know, flying around on the helicopter or something, this could have been a track. But listen, he had 3 weeks to write this score, so maybe, you know, maybe some doodles came in
to borrow something.
I love the Darkman score, but even the Darkman score is also like very Batman. Like it's he the Batman score is a better version of the Darkman score.
Listen, he knew who was buttering his bread back then. He knew what the people wanted.
Well, you know, I'm glad I didn't get yelled at. That's all I'm saying. I'm glad I didn't get yelled at for saying that. Well, not enough in this episode. I'm very fragile. Okay, so at number 13, we've got Nicolette with No Government from the album Let No One Live Rent-Free in Your Head. This is an okay song, but it's really elevated by her voice. She's got that loungy, smoky sort of voice. It's had a bunch of remixes over the years, too, but it's kind of like a great song buried in a merely good song. Like, and I feel like a good remix could pop that potential that it has to be a great song. And I've not heard any of the remixes. I just know that it has like 10 of them now. At number 14, we've got the band Cast with All Right from their album All Change. This is another Britpop band. Like I said, there's a big theme here. It's spy songs and Britpop bands. But they were pretty successful, but they became sort of a footnote because of bands like Blur, Oasis, Pulp. But really, really great shimmery guitar, has sort of snotty sort of sounding vocals, which is a surprise because that's typically not what you find in these. Really good chorus, really great song. But again, I also love Britpop. So, and at number 15, we close with Adam Clayton and Larry Mullen with the Mission Impossible theme, Mission Accomplished. Did either of you play the Nintendo 64 version of Mission Impossible, the game Mission Impossible, when the Nintendo 64 was out? It's not a very well-liked game, but I always loved it. And this kind of sounds like a Nintendo 64 version of the main theme. And I'm-
this is a, so this version's not in the movie, but basically Adam Clayton and Larry Mullen, I think the way the story goes is that they both started their own version of the Mission Impossible theme. Like when they got the job, Larry was like, okay, I'm gonna do some doodles over here. And Adam was like, I'm gonna do some doodles over here. Then they came together and I think it's Larry's who's in the because he's credited first. I think it's Larry who got the track one, which is at the end of the movie. It's the closing credits. And then I think Adam's version is this one that's track 15 at the end of the album that is not in the movie. And it's like another version of the Mission Impossible theme. And it's like different and not quite as good as track one, but it's still kind of fun. But yeah, I guess I didn't play that video game, but we did do a whole episode on all the different video games of Mission Impossible, which are not very well thought of over the years.
Yeah, none of them are very well liked.
There's a reason we're talking about GoldenEye. Even Bono got the better, you know, video game. It's like he really won out on this whole thing. Oh, God.
All right. So that's the soundtrack. Quick wrap up here. So songs in the movie that are not on the soundtrack, none. And actually only five of the songs appear in the movie from the soundtrack. Three of those are the Danny Elfman score. One of them is the one of the two Clayton Mullen Mission Impossible themes. Then the Cranberries Dreams, only songs that actually appear in the movie. Is it on Spotify? It's missing. Actually, the funny thing is Spotify is missing all of the songs I just mentioned, aside from the Cranberries. It's missing the three Elfman score tracks, the Clayton Mullen songs, and the other song it's missing is Salt's So. So, you know, but you could track it all down on YouTube. All right. Let me ask you. The movie, I know your answer already, but I got to ask anyway. So would you consider the first Mission Impossible an essential? Would you say stream it or would you say skip it?
I would say buy the Blu-ray.
4K Blu-ray. 4K Blu-ray.
Yeah,
Steelbook
disc.
Yeah.
Steelbook.
Yeah.
Yeah, if possible. Because I've been on a kick recently where I've gotten back into physical watching Blu-rays because it just looks better than the streaming. But yes, if you have to stream it, stream it.
All right. And I would actually call this an essential. Like I think this is one that you absolutely, like you said, buy the 4K Blu-ray. Yeah, it's my favorite of the whole series. Well, again, saying that without having seen Dead Reckoning yet, but this is my favorite of the whole series as of now. The soundtrack, would you consider this an essential? Stream it, skip it, or cherry pick certain songs off of it?
In my drawer, we are not on camera here, but I have the single. The theme for Mission Impossible with Adam Clayton and Larry Mullen with the paper.
That is awesome.
Yes. Yeah. That,
was that,
but,
the, that
yeah, I think I just like the CD thing.
Have
like a single. We love the vinyl that, that Mo Shafiq over at Mondo Records put out of the first, soundtrack, not the soundtrack, the score. I would say the soundtrack is less essential. Although if you're like us and you are comparing tracks across three different albums, obviously, this is essential to your work and to your research. So, you know, in that regard, it is very essential, I think. But, you know,
in particular, that track Trouble, track 12, is really wonderful on this album. But other than that, I would go with the score, which I also Mondo. Yes, our friend Mo Shafiq has a great vinyl of the first Mission score. But there's also an album that is a CD double disc. What is that? What company is that, Drew? I'm forgetting.
Oh, is that La La Land?
Yes, I think it's La La Land. They did a double disc that has the score, original score album, but then it also has bonus tracks of other stuff that wasn't included in the original. And so it's like it's a you know, mega release of, you know, alternate versions of tracks and stuff, which is really wonderful too. But that's just score, not soundtrack.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm sure at some point there will be an official release of the Alan Silvestri music. Even and that La La Land Records release has an alternate version of Zoom A and Zoom B, so that is just adding to the chaos and confusion of that this situation. Wow. So yeah.
All right. And I would I would consider this, you know what? I'd call this a streamer. I wouldn't even say cherry pick. Like, there's enough, like, I'm saying this to somebody who likes Britpop and I like Massive Attack and stuff, but like, there wasn't a single song in here that I'm like, I want to skip this one. You know what I mean? That's good enough for me to call it a streamer, at least. I wouldn't, but it's definitely not an essential soundtrack by any means. This is a funny one to ask here too. Do the two, and we're talking about the soundtrack we just talked about, not the score. Do the two go well together, the soundtrack and the movie?
There, well, there's nothing. There's no overlap between the soundtrack and the
right,
movie.
Right, right. No, not at all.
Yeah, No. I understand the inclination to want to put a bunch of Britpop, songs, semi-popular Britpop songs on one record, and I wonder what the behind-the-scenes machinations were to compile this album, but I don't really think, they go very well.
If you had to pick one city for this series, the one that they always go back to is London, really, it seems like, right?
Yeah.
Would you agree?
Yeah, Wing in London Town.
So Britpop makes sense, right?
Yeah. The city's so nice, they named it twice. London. Yeah.
All right. And I already know how you're going to answer this, at least somewhat. I don't know the order. But if you had to pick your top three songs off of the soundtrack we just discussed, what would they be?
Ooh. I wish I knew what the Elfman tracks were, other than Trouble, which obviously I've already raved about. I guess I would go with Trouble by Elfman. I would do Dreams by the Cranberries, and then I would do the theme from Mission Impossible by Larry Mullen and Adam Clayton, the track number one, the version that's at the end titles. That's what I would pick.
Okay. I wasn't listening to Charles, but I agree.
All right. I wish I had a co-host who was that. I don't have a co-host, but if I had one, I wish I could find one that was that agreeable with me. My top three, number one is the Larry Mullen, Adam Clayton theme from Mission Impossible. Like, come on, you can't go with another one off of this. Number two would be Cast's All Right. Number three would be the Cranberries' Dream. So further watching, further listening, obviously the sequels, but if you're looking for, there's literally just embarrassment of riches when you come to film, they talk about films that are in the spy film genre, the first Kingsman movie, Ronin, any of the Bond movies, the Bourne movies, really, if you're looking for a good spy film, I would again suggest like stick with any of the sequels from this. If you're looking for a good double feature, you could do this one and Ghost Protocol, Fallout, however you feel like doing it. Even two or three, knock yourselves out. And then as far as further listening, everyone talks about Mezzanine, but Protection is a great Massive Attack album. And Skunk and Nancy's Paranoid and Sunburnt is another great album if you're looking for something to springboard off of this soundtrack. So that's it.
We should have a springboard too. I'm going to suggest the Saint soundtrack from the next year, a much better soundtrack. Also has very little to do with the movie, but it's a movie based on an old 60s spy show, and it has way better people on that one. So listen to the Saint soundtrack. I don't know if it's streaming anywhere, but it's a lot of fun. Duran Duran's on it. Yeah.
I'm doing that one. I've got a guest already lined up for the Saint at some point. We just haven't gotten around to doing it yet, but very good call on that one.
Yeah.
All right. Well, it's your turn now. So you let everyone listening at home know where they can find you. Tell them about the show. Tell them, you know, where they can find you on Twitter, where they can find the show, whatever you want to talk about. The floor is yours. If you want to tell me I'm wrong about Brian De Palma again, you can go ahead and do that. I don't care. It's your turn.
We want everybody to tune into the new version of the show, which is the Mission Impossible, the official Mission Impossible podcast every Tuesday, wherever you listen to podcasts. If you want to follow us on social media, it's Light the Fuse Pod on Instagram and Twitter, or X, or whatever you're calling it these days. And you can follow me and Charles on social media as well. Charles is Charles Hood with two O's. I am Drew Tailored, like a tailored shirt.
Mine's two zeros for the O's.
Yes, Charles Hood. I'm sorry.
With zeros for O's. Yeah. Someone else had my had Charles Hood, so I had to settle for Charles H00D.
It's unique and beautiful like you, Charles. And we want to remind everybody to go see Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning Part 1 exclusively in theaters right now.
All right. And we'll have to do two. You are right. Two is the more interesting soundtrack, but I also didn't want to have two people who host a Mission Impossible show on my podcast and then talk about how much I don't really care for the particular movie we're talking about. You know what I mean?
Yeah, but if you rewatch two in anticipation of this theoretical upcoming episode, maybe you will have more appreciation for it. So think about that.
That's true. I haven't watched two in a very long time, so that could change. And maybe I will be one of those people who's like, two's better than three now. You know what I mean? Who knows? It's been a long time.
Yeah.
No, seriously, had a good time doing this with you. And thanks for schooling me on some of the score stuff that I didn't know. So
yeah, good time doing this. Thanks for having us. Listen, you never have to apologize about talking Mission Impossible to us. We will talk about it until we die, which might happen. So yeah, we love it. And we really thank you for having us on. And
all right. Yes, you can't die before we do part two.
Yes, we'll be back for part two for sure.
Okay. Yeah. All right. You two have a great night. And everyone listening at home, thank you so much for listening. And I hope that all of you have a tremendous weekend.
Ain't no use running. Ain't nowhere to hide. The beast is coming and he's got you in his sights. He ain't gonna miss you and he ain't gonna mess around. If you're a movie with original songs.